Hello and welcome to another episode of the Student Loan Planner Podcast. Today I'm going to talk about PS Left Buyback and whether or not it's going to be around. And I'm also going to talk about listener questions that people have because it's been a little while since we've done a listener question mailbag. I'm going to call out the first question from Wahid. I'm not going to play it for y'all because it's very long and he's very much stressed with the buyback program. So I thought I would just give you kind of a highlight of what he's struggling with. He's wondering about what repayment plan he needs to be on, when he can apply for it, if it's going to be around. You can tell in his voice that he's quite worried about it. I wanted to call out a couple of key things to know about PSLF buyback. You can only apply when you're at 120 months of total qualifying employment. That's what triggers your ability to apply for PSLF buyback. Remember, qualifying employment is working full-time at a not-for-profit or government employer for 120 months after a period where you exited your grace period on your student loans. What you can do along the way while you're waiting to apply for PSLF buyback is certify your employment at studentaid.gov/PSLF. You don't have to worry about being in forbearance or repayment when you apply for it, because if you overpay, they will refund you. So a lot of times I get the question, which repayment plan do I need to be on? I'm not eligible for all of them. I'm scared. Don't be scared. Sign up for any repayment plan that is eligible for PSLF, IBR, ICR, Pay, whatever you can get on it. And while you are being evaluated for PSLF buyback, when you throw your hat in the ring, you're also continuing to grow credit towards PSLF just in case it doesn't work out for some reason. And if you overpay, you get refunded. That's in general how it works. Now, we have seen people successfully get PSLF buyback offers and get forgiveness. I get that question all the time. And the great news is that I can tell you confidently that we do see people get it. The problem is, just as in the beginning with PSLF, when we first saw PSLF approvals start happening, it was very few and far between. And it ramped up a ton over time. Now, one big thing we should think about is there's a big difference between the processing speed of a Democratic versus Republican administration when it comes to student loans. Why? A Democratic administration, like the Biden-Harris administration, tends to think in terms of, we want this to happen as fast as possible, and we don't want to throw up undue barriers to getting forgiveness and processing forgiveness, so we're going to not put things under a ton of scrutiny. We're going to rush stuff out the door. Now, by and large, the people getting the forgiveness do qualify for it, but they're a lot more concerned about the speed of processing versus the accuracy. Republican administration officials tend to be a lot more concerned about the accuracy versus the speed. And in general, I believe that most of the Republican administrations out there would be described as being anti-PSLF, PSLF buyback, especially PSLF for doctors, which a lot of folks that listen to this podcast, that's you, right? Just calling that out, that there is ideological opposition to the program existing in the first place. And while they might be obligated to do it under the current regulations, one thing that's important to think about is PSLF is in the law, but PSLF buyback is not. PSLF buyback is a regulation the Biden-Harris administration put into place, and they never envisioned it existing for purposes of buying back credit en masse. That was not at all why they created it. They created it so that people that were put into forbearances improperly could be able to buy that period back when they hit the 120 months of qualifying employment to remedy how many people were steered into forbearance by servicers instead of more affordable income-based repayment programs, because it was way faster for the employees on the phone to say, sign up for forbearance versus taking somebody's income information. And then the servicers managed the people on the phone according to how long their phone calls were. And so basically it was against the interest of any employee on the phone to offer income-based repayment, because they were judged in part due to how fast you get somebody off the call. They were measured that way because the speed at which you got people off the call was directly relating to how many FTEs you needed to sit in the seats. And these servicer contracts are bid out on a low cost basis. So whoever bids the lowest amount often gets the contract. And so with those kinds of incentives, it's just bad incentives all around. So that's why they made the PSLF buyback program in the first place, to really help maybe a few thousand people. It was not intended to be a broad scale program at all. But what happened is, when everybody got put into save forbearance in June of 2024, give or take, during the Biden-Harris administration, suddenly you had millions of people become eligible for PSLF buyback. So you're talking, I think it was 9 million people in the save forbearance at one point, and 25% of people on average are on PSLF with an income-based repayment, maybe more like 30% these days, probably. So you're talking about 3 million people that are eligible for PSLF buyback, probably. So 3 million people, 3 million borrowers, they have to apply knowingly when they reach 120 months of credit. PSLF is an exponential type of approval setup because of just how many cohorts of people took out loans at certain times. As an example, you know, the first medical school class that had only direct loans started in 2010, finished in 2014, and then was eligible for PSLF if they applied immediately in the middle of 2024. So over time, like the people of, that are eligible for PSLF sort of exponentially increases until it sort of is going to level off. And thinking about who's applying for PSLF buyback, right now 70,000 people have applied for it, and then only about 7,000 have been processed. That ratio continues to get worse. In other words, they fall continually more and more behind in PSLF buyback processing because of how many people are eligible for it and how many people are throwing their hat in the ring. Now, the problem with PSLF buyback processing is it's not in the law, and PSLF is. So PSLF buyback, again, is regulation from the Biden-Harris administration. That means with the negotiated rulemaking that they're doing at Department of Ed, they could kill this. They could kill PSLF buyback. And frankly, I think they probably will. What will that mean for people who are currently eligible for it? Well, I think that anybody who qualifies for PSLF buyback before the regulation goes away, some people will get it. People that qualify for PSLF buyback after the regulation, and I shouldn't say goes away, I should say potentially goes away, because we don't know for sure that it's going to go away. You know, if we think about the math for those folks, you're obviously not going to get it if it goes away. The question is, when would it go away? Well, let's say they publish the regulation by November of this year. It wouldn't go into effect until July of following year 2026. So with 70,000 pending applications, only 7,000 have been processed. You could argue that it might even be intentionally slow in the processing of PSLF buyback, because perhaps if you're not processing that fast, maybe you could throw up your hands and stop the buyback process in general by just taking your sweet time, which is one reason the American Federation of Teachers is suing Department of Ed to try to force them to process IBR and PSLF according to existing laws and regulations and not slow walk things. It's a mess. You know this if you listen to this podcast for years. It's generally always a mess of some kind. But, you know, this is why the PSLF buyback program is so difficult, because the Department of Ed is super understaffed. At the time I'm recording this, we were even in a government shutdown. And so things are just moving at a snail's pace. That's why I suggest people continue making repayments, continue making progress towards PSLF. Don't build your life and dreams around buyback working. You cannot. If you do, you will probably be disappointed. View buyback as a just positive extra bonus that you might get. That's the way I would think about it. If you get it, great. Do not plan your life around it. Do not expect that everything in the world will work out perfectly with buyback, because, again, it's a program from Biden-Harris kind of years that's in regulation, not in law, whereas PSLF is in law, so that's secure and buyback is not. So we just have to kind of continue to wait. There's not a great other answer that I've got for folks, but continue applying for buyback and continue while you're getting ready for buyback, make sure all your employment credit certified. So we're going to talk about other things. Let's listen to a couple other questions that we've got from listeners.
Hello, Travis. I have four quick questions. I have 13 federal student loans. I've paid off two that total $242,000 for undergraduate, graduate, and law school. Under PSLF, I have 82 remaining payments on 9 loans, 55 and 60 remaining payments on 2 loans, and 62 remaining payments on 1. In sum, I have between 4.5 and 6.8 years of qualifying payments depending on the loan before forgiveness kicks in, because I have not consolidated my loans. So question one, is my understanding correct that as I make qualifying payments under PSLF, my total balance will decrease over time as I receive forgiveness sooner from those earlier undergraduate and graduate loans that have accumulated more qualifying payments towards them? Okay, more information. I'm presently on the SAVE plan and have not been able to make qualifying payments due to the litigation-induced forbearance and the need to switch to the next best option given the OBBB. So I can begin to make qualifying payments again under PSLF. My goal is to work in my state government job for the next 6.8 years I need left for full public service loan forgiveness. Question two, what plan will be best for me to switch to now? And am I locked into a plan once I switch? Do I switch to pay, IBR, or pay and then IBR at some point in the future, and new IBR, old IBR? Question three, my husband and I are typically file taxes jointly. We were unaware of the benefits to student loan payments if we filed separately. If I haven't yet filed separately for my husband, do I need to wait until we file 2025 taxes separately and then apply for recertification to get that lower monthly payment to demonstrate that we have filed separately to qualify for lower monthly payments. And then question four, when I receive forgiveness in 6.8 years, will we be taxed on the amount forgiven? I didn't realize that was a thing until recently. And if so, how do you recommend offsetting that cost? Thank you so much. I really appreciate your time.
So this is a great series of questions. And, you know, to be really honest, whenever somebody has more than a couple questions, you know, a student loan consult is a better decision than me just giving somebody, you know, a tip in the podcast because of just how many things that all these different questions interact with and impact. That's the only caveat that I would say is if somebody needs to file taxes separately, but their spouse makes $600,000 a year and they make $150,000 a year, and that would create a $25,000 a year tax burden. And you'd have to talk about whether or not you want to amend your taxes to deal with that and when you would amend those returns to potentially deal with that. You know, all that's very complicated. And so I just want to throw out this is a high level response. It's not a personal response. That's why we have the consult service, right? But to answer some of those questions, when in doubt, hang out on the save forbearance until you're forced out of it if you are not sure what to do. If you have a plan and you know what to do, get out of the save forbearance because that's the smart thing to do. But if you are really unsure of what to do, you might be waiting on getting a good tax return first, then it's better to hold off until you've got the great tax return you need, you're sure you're needing to get on the new IBR plan, and you're ready to switch to it, and you're ready to make that payment. You're ready to get more progress going towards PSLF. In general, this listener is better off on new IBR if she is eligible for it. The reason is if you have different loans that are forgiven at different dates, then you really want something that's got a cap, and you want something that's going to be capped out at the standard 10-year plan for each one of the loans. So in other words, what happened is her payment overall on her IBR plan would be the same regardless of how much loans that she's got. But eventually what will happen, depending on the loan forgiveness dates, is the required payment on IBR might be higher than the standard 10-year plan across all the remaining loans when some of them get forgiven and some of them don't. So to throw out an example, let's say her IBR payment's $1,000 a month. Let's say that she's got $200,000. She had said $240,000, I think, but let's just for easy math, let's say she's got $200,000 of federal student loans and she's got $1,000 a month IBR payment. And let's say a year, she gets another couple years of credit, and let's say $150,000 of the $200,000 are forgiven, and there's $50,000 remaining that don't have enough credit to get forgiven yet. Well, her IBR payment is $1,000 a month. The remaining loans that are not consolidated, right, is $50,000. And so that would work out to a standard 10-year plan of about $500 a month, which is less than $1,000 for the IBR payment. So in that case, her payment would get capped at the $500 a month IBR payment, and she might not need to file taxes separately anymore. She might be able to just file joint because when you're at the cap, it doesn't really matter if you file joint or separate. This stuff can get complicated in a real hurry. And so that's just kind of like the high level advice that I'd give. And if she needs a student loan consult, the person who left the question, you know, studentloanplanner.com/book. Let's listen to another question from a listener.
Hi, Travis. Question for you regarding save. I am in my mid-70s. I have $135,000 in the save forbearance. Haven't paid for quite a while, as you can imagine. I know you keep telling people like myself to switch and go over to IBR, but I cannot for the life of me figure out why I would want to do that. First of all, each year, my income is going down. Second of all, I really don't care about the interest accruing because in 20 or 30 years, when the loan is at its end, I'm not going to be around. And there's no reason to refi because my current loan, whatever it is not going to be forced to be paid upon by my estate and my family. So for me, it's just wait as long as I can and then start paying as little as I can per month. And that's my strategy. If I'm wrong, please let me know.
So, you know, this is why I always say, and when a lot of people ask me questions, sometimes, yes, it very much depends. I will say for someone in their mid-70s, yes, it depends on how much credit you've got on your loans, right? If you've got 23 years worth of credit on your loans and you need another two to get forgiven under an IBR program, then you kind of do want to think about getting into repayment and getting this over with because, you know, if somebody's in their mid-70s, you very well could live into your mid-80s, late 80s, early 90s, or mid-90s, or beyond, right? If you, you know, obviously life expectancy is conditional, and if you look at the conditional probability of the Social Security actuarial tables of somebody in their mid-70s living to their 90s, it's actually higher than you would expect because you don't have the, you know, the folks who have passed away before those mid-70s, so it's a conditional probability. Without nerding out too hard, though, if you think you could stretch the loan out at least 15 years, then I would say that delay, delay, delay is definitely the name of the game. You know, I would even wonder, could you use forbearance? There's some rules and really complex rules with forbearance that roll out soon that basically say that after a certain date, you're only going to be able to do 9 months of forbearance within a 24-month period. And so that's going to be a big limitation from what it used to be, which is 12 months of forbearance approved by 1 year increments up to 3 years total of forbearance. So a lot of times for folks in that situation that are, you know, older, we tend to say, yeah, max out your forbearance, max out as many periods of non-payment as you can because your retirement income is going to be lower than your earning years income and see if you can do the die with a debt strategy. Not that that's a bad strategy. In some cases, it's a good strategy because it enables you to live. You know, if you think about what is a die with a loan strategy, it allows you to retire. It allows you to leave some money to the next generation. If somebody's in their mid-70s, if you're planning a die with a debt strategy, I would also think about meeting with an estate attorney to have a long-term plan for when and if you need to move into assisted living or a nursing home or something to that effect. If your plan is to have Medicaid pick up the tab for that, which is what most middle-class people do by accident because they don't buy long-term care, they don't have $2 million saved up for retirement. So if that's what's going to happen with long-term care, Medicaid, Medicare paying for it, then generally people will put the primary home into a trust before they go so that their offspring can get that asset, which is excluded from the Medicaid calculations in terms of how much they will, you know, Medicaid basically requires you to reduce your assets down to a certain level before they'll pay for stuff. And so there's a bunch of planning strategies that middle class people do. I even know an estate attorney who all day, every day is just doing like middle class trusts for people that are in their 80s that are going to probably go to an assisted living facility in 5 to 10 years. So some fun things to think about. I was thinking about my own mortality the other day because I was thinking about when I was 15 and I'm in my mid-30s now. And I was thinking, gosh, it's almost the same distance from my early teen years as it is to me being 60. Oh my gosh. So I guess people probably think about like mortality a lot when you get older. And hopefully I get the joy of growing older and be in my mid-70s one day like the listener who asked the question. So thank you for asking this question. And let's take one additional question.
Hi, Travis and the Student Loan Planner team. I was calling in to ask about recertifying off cycle and how that works. For context, I am changing jobs sometime next year to a PSLF eligible job that will be about half as much income. It seems like I'm a little crazy taking half as much money, but I am so excited about the career change. I will be recertifying with my current private practice income before that happens. So obviously, as soon as my income changes, I want to be able to recertify. I was wondering, in your experience, how long does it take for that recertification off cycle to kick in, to be reflected in your payment? And then also, when I am sending in a non-tax return version of that, is it best that I wait until I'm able to show pay stubs? Am I able to show my, you know, offer letter? How exactly does that work for income recertification if I am not able to yet have a tax return that reflects that? And if I have multiple income sources, how do I make sure that all of those are reflected and I don't get in trouble? All right. Thanks so much. Bye.
So the great news is Department of Ed really doesn't care all that much. So if you go to studentaid.gov/IDR, you can recalculate your payment and they give you a lot of different things that you can use to recertify your payment. Pay stubs, you know, letter from your employer, you pretty much can do whatever you want. I guess what I would say is just they give you an opportunity at whenever you have to recertify your income at all, ever. It says, you know, has your income decreased significantly since you filed your last tax return? If your current taxable income is lower than your last tax return, then you always want to say, yes, it's decreased, and then use this alternative documentation of income to certify. How long does it take? Probably a couple months. It depends on what you're submitting, right? It depends on if you're submitting a pay stub, probably a lot faster. If you're submitting a paper letter from your employer that a human has to review, it's probably going to be longer. I would not worry too much about it. You know, we don't really You know, what I like to tell people just to encourage them is that, you know, you can't move the student loan servicer oil tanker. It's big, it's rusty, it takes forever to turn, it takes forever to start and stop it. You'll go crazy if you try to get tactical and say, you know, I'm going to immediately certify on this day, this many days before my required payments due, and then I'm going to, you know, it's going to be pulled out on this exact day. Like, if you overthink this, you'll go nuts. So try not to overthink it. Just realize it's just going to be what it's going to be, and there's no way around it. The way I would think about it is be ready to do it as soon as you resign from your job, as soon as you take the new job, as soon as you quit, go recertify right away. And yeah, I would not worry about like what they ask you to do. I think it's going to work out just fine. One downside though, a lot of times there's a misconception out there that people think, oh, I'm going to recertify, and then it's going to reset my clock and I'm going to be on a new, you know, 1 year cycle until they'll ask for it again. I don't think that's usually how it works. Usually you're going to stay on the same cycle. They're still going to ask for your income, but you know, anything's possible with the way the servicers are these days. But just generally speaking, there's not a lot of people think there's times when you can strategically recertify your income. You know, like I get a lot of times people will be like the recertification date is in June or something, and they're about to take a new attending job or something, and they're like, I want to recertify before I file my tax return like October 12th. And then it's like, well, that doesn't really help. Your income's going up anyway, so it's not like you're getting a lower payment. It's about the same payment. It's not going to like impact, you know, how long you get that payment for. So there is a lot of strategy with income certifications and when to do it and when to file tax returns on time, when to do extensions. There is a ton of strategy behind that. It's just like, the nice part is in this case, it's just pretty straightforward. When your income drops, go tell them about it. If you want to ask a question like these other listeners did, the way you do that is studentloanplanner.com/voicemail, and you can record a maybe 30 second to 90 second question on your phone. Really easy, takes like a very short amount of time, and other people benefit from it too. People like to hear what other people are asking about or wondering about, and I like to hear it as well because it shows me what's on your mind at the moment. Right now, student loans are a little bit quieter than they are usually. We're waiting on a lot of court actions. We're waiting on a lot of court cases, and sometimes quiet is a blessing. And so we will be monitoring things for when it's not quiet. The not quiet that we're expecting is, you know, a random 8th Circuit Court decision, a negotiated rulemaking that issues a bunch of new regulations that people get worried about, the implementation of the loan cliff in July 2026 for when, you know, a lot of things have to be done by that date if you want to get into one of the old IBR plans versus the new RAP plan. So we'll cover all those dates. You don't have to worry about it. We've got your back. If you need a student loan consult, studentloanplanner.com/book. Thank you all for listening to the SLP podcast, and I hope you have a great rest of your week. Are you on the free Student Loan Planner email list? If yes, you can upgrade your experience and discover student loan loopholes so good, they might get repealed if I talk about them publicly. Find out my very best thought leadership that I really just can't be super open about anymore, unfortunately. If you want to get our very best tips, not just the ones that I can share for free, go to studentloanplanner.com/insider to get a special discount for your year membership. That's studentloanplanner.com/insider and get our very best dozens of bonus content and tips that's going to save you money and get you out of student debt faster. And if you're already an SLP insider, please reply back to those emails and let me know how I can make it even more valuable.